Well, hi everybody. Again, welcome to our Samsara and Nirvana, and we're doing a class four today. So let's begin as we normally do by setting our motivation and saying the preliminary prayers. So please just get comfortable in your seat. So ideally your feet will be on a cushion on the floor. Your shoulders should be relaxed and the back reasonably straight. Just check to see if your head is sitting evenly on your neck. And if you like, you can close your eyes completely or partially. Being comfortable, allow the body to breathe itself. Being present and feeling at ease. Imagine the Shakyamuni Buddha and his spiritual entourage appear in the space before you. So the Buddha is golden in color and he's sitting on a golden throne. You yourself are sitting on a seat and you're surrounded by all sentient beings who are also similarly seated. Recollect that everyone equally wishes to avoid suffering, equally wishes to be happy, and equally lacks genuine happiness. But the causes of suffering can be eliminated, and this potential for genuine happiness, which abides equally within all of us, can be worked with. We can dispel the causes of suffering and we can actualize genuine happiness. But to do so, we have to abandon different phenomena, and particularly the causes of suffering. We need to adopt other phenomena that will bring about genuine happiness. In other words, a path. Decide to create this path which will bring about the cessation of every cause of suffering, so that all origins are completely abandoned, and that fruit called enlightenment is achieved. The thing that enlightenment here means that you have perfect wisdom, compassion, and skill that is able to help others remove the origins of their suffering. To help you, rely upon the Buddha, the Dharma, and his community. Join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through the seat of the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through the seat of the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through the seat of the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this prayer, I think that rays of nectar and light stream forth from the heart of the Buddha and his entourage. These lights of nectars remove the obstacles to spiritual practice. And we feel that our potentials of method and wisdom have been empowered. Through this empowerment, we recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love and compassion, joy and equanimity. We decide to establish these ourselves and then help everyone else do the same. To affirm this, we say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. in response to this prayer, again, let's let this stream fall from the heart of each enlightened being. They remove our obstacles and they empower our potentials of message and wisdom. So then we prepare to purify the mind, to accumulate and to increase the merit. And we do this by reciting the seven limb prayer. So please join me in saying, reverently I prosper with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering at your dimension. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cycle consistency and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and other spirits to great enlightenment. Now, to prevent us grasping at our practices of purification and accumulation of merit, recollect emptiness and knowing that all phenomena are empty of any intrinsic reality. Imagine your body, your merits, in fact, every object in your senses is utterly transformed and reappears as a pure land for teaching. And we're going to offer this to the Buddha and his entourage. And so we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents of sun and moon. I imagine this as a Buddha-fearing monopoly. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. So, made the offering to the Buddha, he accepts it and he smiles at us. Now, we look up, we gaze into the eyes of the Buddha. We feel accepted and at ease and have this feeling that whatever we request is being accepted and will come about. Now, an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart, moves through space, and comes to the bottom of the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. Now, this emanation begins to descend down to the level of your heart, whereby it begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light and nectars. And these nectars and light pour out through the pores of the skin. They fill the tender axis of space. And they establish every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. You can think here that you've accomplished the two purposes. Enlightenment for yourself and enlightenment for others. And within the state of enlightenment, you hear the mantra of Shakyamuni the Buddha. And join in reciting it and then say it a few times under your breath. Now the lights withdraw from the ten directions of space and then reabsorbed by the heart. You can hear sounds of traffic passing by, you can feel the hardness of the seat beneath you. So you are embodied once again. Acknowledge that this meditation is one of imagination. And it has imprinted the mind with this possibility for awakening. The thing to bring about this full awakening and need to depend upon an authentic spiritual teacher. Now, you can rely upon them correctly. And it's for that purpose that we're studying this module. And now breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale forcefully through the mouth. And with your eyes flutter open and move your body into the way you'd like to. Okay. So these here are some of the books that I've been relying upon. I don't think they've changed at all, these first three or four classes. These three books down the bottom here are the four books on the bottom shelf, all by His Holiness and Venerable Thupten Tsering. I just keep recommending these because I think they are the best presentation of all. A book up here called Steps on the Path to Enlightenment that has quite good, well, very good commentary on this topic, how to rely on a spiritual teacher. And the other books, of course, have to do with the Four Noble Truths, which are sort of one of the basics in this module. So we began, we looked at, we began by looking at what samsara was. Can anybody remember what samsara is anymore? what is samsara? Yeah, psychic existence, which means what? What is psychic existence then? So it's the process whereby your aggregates take control under the control. Your aggregates take rebirth under the control of karma and delusion. Other terms you could use, you could say, well, it's the process of striving for something, achieving it, and then being dissatisfied. Or having the mind, like I said, go up and down all the time. Yeah.
Esther online said, for her, it's a hamster wheel is what comes to her mind.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And so that's nirvana then. Say that one again, please.
It's the attainment of bliss through the realization of one.
So nirvana is basically the absolute nature of the mind. It's the absence of the causes for samsara. That's how. So what are the causes for samsara? Yeah, karma and delusion are the causes. Samsara's origins are karma and delusion. When these origins are absent from the mind, we have nirvana. And so we put the four noble truths.
Truth of suffering.
Truth of suffering. Truth of origin.
Cause of suffering.
Yeah.
Cessation.
Cessation of suffering and the path of cessation. Okay, so you go to know these things, really straight, simple things up again and again and again and again. And then we looked at the three types of suffering. So what are the three forms of suffering? Now we've got the three sufferings, the six sufferings, the eight sufferings, 25. There's three different ways of describing it, but these are three that are often put forward in terms of teaching beginners like ourselves.
Suffering.
Suffering of change. Suffering of change and the suffering of? All pervasive compounded suffering. So I'll ask you these things, sort of things each time we start, right? Because we're going through these are really basic sort of questions. So over time, we ought to try and remember what they mean. Now, so we look at the suffering. When you say the suffering of change. Yes, and that suffering we call happiness. Because it's a decrease in the suffering. Well, it's all suffering. This is something you've got to get your head around. Samsara is all suffering. So these sufferings are taking place within samsara. So they're not happiness. But they have what we call, remember last week we talked about when our suffering decreases, we call that happiness. We call the suffering of change pleasure. Yeah, it's just degrees of it. So if you said, so in terms of this pain and suffering on the continuum, pain is right over here. And about midway is what this thing called suffering of change, called happiness. And right now, there's the other cycle of all pervasive conditioning. It's a real good idea to get your head around this. It's like for us, like, what do we strive for? We call it like happiness. What sort of happiness? The happiness of samsara. And that's suffering. But the happiness of samsara is the suffering of change. We want to get out of that equanimous state of the deepest suffering. You know, just being like we are now, right? We just sort of say, we're not suffering, obviously, are we? And we're not really joyful and happy, are we? That's called the suffering of all pervasive conditionality. Because that can change at any moment. If I walked over to you and slapped your face, our sense of equanimity would change immediately, wouldn't it? Go straight to suffering. Right. So this is what you really do, because otherwise, there's nothing to stop you trying to be happy in samsara, is there? If you see samsara as a place of happiness, why would you want to leave it? And this is what this is the biggest problem. It's the hardest thing for us to do. We like the sufferings of samsara. We like the suffering of change.
Conditioning, isn't it?
Yeah, it's right. It's just been conditioned this way. Yes, one of those things when you're about, like I said, you're not distressed in any way. But for me, most of it, the suffering of all pervasive conditionality manifests to me as boredom. It's like, I want to change. So I'll go to the movies, I'll go turn the radio on, I'll go to the fridge. That means we're not happy with this, nothing happening. We want to get ahead. You know, so we do that. We think, oh, great. Now I experience pleasure. This is good. So we usually stay in there. But my reason for this is we really don't know anything any different. You know, you might read about states like Nirvana, which we do. We try to imagine, but we've probably never had any sort of experience like that.
And one thing I've discovered when examining pleasure for myself is, once you really look at it, you have to work so hard to get pleasure. Like when you really check it, and then when you do have it, it doesn't last very long, and you have to work hard again to get the next thing of pleasure. Like until I really checked, I didn't realize how hard I had to work each time, and you just can't hold on to it.
And you don't have to work hard at all to get suffering, do you? Not at all. But states of pleasure, what we call happiness, take a lot of effort, and then we have to maintain it. Now, it requires a lot of effort to like keep feeling pleasurable, doesn't it? Or to, like I say, feel happy. It's a very different way of looking at things. That's for sure. And so over time, do try to get this idea on the spectrum of suffering that we call samsara, we have obvious pain. Then we can have the diminishment of that pain, meaning the pain decreases. And in dependence on this decrease, we feel better. And we call that happiness. But still on this spectrum. And then we go further and then we sort of become some neutral. We don't really feel, we're certainly not feeling unpleasant, we're not feeling pleasant, we're just sort of ordinary, you might say, neutral. But that state, I guess we can change just like that, isn't it? If we get slapped or stand on something sharp, immediately it feels painful. If somebody says, it's so good to see you again, I've had a great win, here's $10,000. We feel immediately happy, wouldn't we? And so this is what I mean. This state is not, it's not secure. It doesn't stay the same, this sense of neutrality. It changes because depending on the condition. A slap makes us upset. $10,000 makes us really happy. And then as you find out, you know, that buzz of the 10 grand, it's suddenly you're back to normal, aren't you?
Or you have to worry about how to spend your 10 grand.
Where am I going to put it? Well, yeah, all sorts of things can arise. It might not just be pleasure. But you have moments of, oh, how lucky I am, but then you might have all sorts of worries. And like I said, it's not under our control. It's just taking place. To control it, we have to exert effort again. Suffering, the first one, suffering pain, means any sort of pain. Going right down from just the prick of your finger here like this to having a massive headache or finding yourself in a traffic accident. You know, something really heavy that's obvious to us and it does not require thinking about. You know you're hurting. That's the suffering of pain or the suffering of suffering. So I know the English words are a bit difficult because you know, we think suffering straight away goes to obvious pain. But this is just one level of suffering. Then this next one, of course, is the suffering of change or the dukkha of change. And that's what I'm saying, where the obvious pain decreases in such a manner that you feel better. Now, like, anyone ever had those migraine headaches? Oh man, they're terrible. If you ever have one of those, and you try to stop it, don't you? So you probably get aspirins and you do whatever you could, heat packs, cold packs, whatever you do. You do it and you're waiting and you're hoping like heck that thudding will decrease. Now when it does, you feel better. Again, that's a suffering of change. The other one, of course, is like the example of a chocolate cake. You take something you know gives you pleasure and you keep taking it. And what will happen is your pleasure doesn't get more, it turns into suffering. And so even the good things, you have too much of them. Suddenly they're not so good for you. So these are the two aspects. You know, just this decrease and you know you feel better. The other is taking something and keep them by them, keep using them. Now, if you've ever been addicted to yourself or ever talked to an addict, oftentimes what they tell you about is how great it feels the first time, right? And then you go, yeah, well, why are you homeless? Why have you got no shoes? Why have you got no money? Why don't people trust you? Well, I kept using that thing that made me feel good. So what originally started off when it was got this terrible. Yeah, of course you can, but most of us, what we do, we just want to stop it, don't we? We don't sit there and think, well, we've got a headache. It's very difficult to think, why have I got a headache? All you want to do is to stop it. Mm-hmm. And you know, you don't need to think, well, I know how to stop it. Go to the medicine cabinet and grab the medicine as quick as you can. Don't think about why I've got it. That might come up later on while I've calmed down. Mm-hmm. But look, I tell you what, if people say that they're suffering, you should agree with them. Because you ask yourself, do they have control over their five aggregates?
Yeah, try to adjust your body or do something about it.
There's a simple one, really. But the way of dividing phenomena up, right? One simple way is you can go, those who are enlightened and those who aren't. Those who aren't are suffering. You can actually make another level. You could go, those who are not suffering at all, those who are on a path whereby they may have removed some level of suffering. But they're still suffering. It's just not as badly as they normally would be because they know the methods, they have the medicine. Then you have other people who are just suffering and they don't have the medicine, they just have to suffer to what people's out. And that group of people is a vast majority of human beings. And animals too. You know, you think all the animals, they don't have a methodology to get rid of the origins of their suffering, they just have to bear it. Yes, it does, but it's normal. And you'll also notice that as it's normal, these headaches return, our problems return. This is cyclic existence. It goes all the way up to being reborn under the control of these factors, then you have the life and it's under the control of those factors. It doesn't stop. Then you get to death and still under the control of factors. So the idea of Dharma is to find some way of us gaining control over the process. And so the way to do that is to do these analyses to work out how does it function? How does samsara function? Because if we can do that, then you can break into it and break it apart. But if you don't know how it works, it's just going to keep on working. But all you can do is you just feel dejected about it. But this whole, really, the teachings of the Dharma would never have been explained if there was no antidote. So there is an antidote here. On this side, we're just talking about, yeah, these three sufferings. They can all be stopped. But to stop them, you've got to work out how they work, how they function, what's driving them. This sort of thing. Once we get that, yeah, okay, now I know what to do.
I see.
Yes, well, we're never off already. Okay, let's have a look. So today's topics. We're going to look at these delusions. They're one of the major causes of the origin of suffering. And we're going to look at ignorance, anger, and attachment of these six root delusions. We'll look at some antidotes for the delusions and show you how antidotes actually work. Quite simple, actually, how the antidote works. Well, I can explain it simply, but also you can go into quite a bit of depth in each stage of its development. Okay, let's look at the delusion first of all. And this is a general definition. So definitions change depending upon the different systems of learning called tenet systems. But here's a definition which is accepted by everyone. A mental factor that arises from distorted attention, making the mind unpeaceful and uncontrolled. So delusions are actually our truest enemies, because their only function is to cause harm. They never do anything good for you, they're harmful. These delusions occur when we focus on objects in an inappropriate way. This is really important, this inappropriate way. And it's through this inappropriate way we exaggerate their attractive or unattractive qualities. This exaggerated focus leads directly to the negative emotions like attachment and anger. But if a person were completely free of these disturbing mental factors, then their only experience would be peace and contentment. So to find this lasting peace or the contentment of it, the true cessation in nirvana, we begin by learning to identify these negative mental states. A mental factor arises from distorted attention. So I should talk about distorted attention. So this is really important, and you should check it out. So we have attention, and somehow or other it's been distorted. Or the attention is being, the attention is in some way inappropriate to the object. So we've got visual attention. It's about our eyes, and we can see things. Okay, so when we look at the phenomena around us, so the eye takes a colour and shape. Where does the colour and shape of the objects appear to be? Of course, they do to me. We go, it looks like a red cushion over there, looks like a square shape. That's where they appear to be. Are they? And they're not. We agree conventionally, it's in normal terms of speech, we'd say, yeah, that cushion's red, it's square. And there's nothing wrong with that, we'd all agree with that. But if you actually look for where is the squareness of that red cushion, where is the colour? I'm sure all of us would say they're over there. None of us would say it's drawn back here. And that's what I'm saying. So that type of attention is wrong. It's a wrong form of attention. If you look into that, if you want to, go online and look up for the history of colour and shape. In science, or they all show there's no such, they're not out there. They're not over there. Which is really strange, isn't it? It certainly looks that way. Same sort of thing where you hear the sounds. Where do you hear the sounds? Where are they coming from? They're all out there, aren't they?
They seem to be.
They seem to be, aren't they? That's right. They appear to be. They seem to be. And this is where Buddhism tells you there is a major sense of disharmony or disconnect. Because although it looks like that, appears like that, looks like that, and red and the shape of don't exist like that. This is really useful to get your head around, and you want to get your head around it as quickly as possible. To go, whatever object that's taken in by my senses whether it be visual, auditory, olfactory, feeling, even thinking. It's all going to appear to me as if they have an inherent existence, as if they don't actually depend upon my mind and the labeling process. So this book you sort of got to get your head around and check it. You know, like, go up against it. All I'm saying is, you've got this thing, now see if you can find a way of disagreeing with it. We end up coming around like it's a pretty strange world, but everything appears to be out there, but in fact it's not. So this type of attention is called inappropriate. So conventional cognitions, the ability to see, think, smell, whatever the object that gets at, the object's going to appear to that conventional cognition, the conventional knower, whether it be your eyes or your ears or your mind, as if it truly exists. So truly, the word truly exists means it's existing in the way that it appears to you. But this is not how it exists. Do you sort of understand what I'm trying to say here? Okay, well, it can be quite simple. You want to make it quite simple in a way. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, on a conventional level, without examination. That's right. You don't need to argue that. That's not the point. That's not the place to argue. It's the thing that when you actually look for the colour itself, you know, or the shape itself, that is not dependent upon the senses, in other words. But the sense of the shape, it seems to be like over there, really over there. Yeah, so I need to check this out again and again, because if you've got the object to be negated is inherent existence. But inherent existence doesn't actually exist at all. See what it appears to. So you can have something that doesn't exist at all, but can appear to exist. Yeah, appears to be inherently existent, but it's not. So it appears to inherently exist, but it does not inherently exist. Yeah, so I'll give you another one of how you can see how something can appear to you, but it doesn't exist in the way it appears to us. Of course, these sunglasses exist.
Mm-hmm.
Of course they do. But can you see them changing moment by moment? Do they look as if they're changing?
No.
But they are. So here's another example. Here you've got something that exists. It appears to not change, but it is changing. You can look at a chair or that red cushion thing. It appears to inherently exist, but it doesn't inherently exist.
Because it's changing.
Because it's dependent. In terms of the cushion, but here, it appears to be permanent, but it doesn't exist as a permanent thing. Why? Because it changes. So here we are again, like I'm saying, if you, simple example, anything around you, none of it appears to be changing. Well, it depends, because things change at different rates. Or perhaps they're changing really rapidly, and we don't have the sense just to see the change. Whether it's slow or really fast, we can't tell.
Well, from working in the hospital, I often have patients say to me, "I just bent over and lift this thing up, and suddenly my back was aching and really sore." But what they haven't realized is there's been a change that has been slowly happening over time, and that was the tip of the iceberg, and suddenly they're in a lot of pain. So it was a slow change, but it's just as significant when you experience the pain when it finally tips over. So anyway.
The idea here is, what I'm trying to get you here to look at is to say, so here you've got something like a person or a pair of glasses or anything in this room, right? It's all undergoing change right now. Right? Does it appear to be doing so? No, it doesn't. That it actually is, isn't it? So again, these objects can appear to have inherent existence, but in fact they don't have it. So these objects all appear to have permanence, which is this absence of change. Things are stable, they look that way. But again, you ask, are they? You go, no. Yeah, I mean, the building could burn down, couldn't it? It's all gone straight away, but that potential was always there. They give lots of examples in the text that you want to take advantage of. For instance, if you look at your reflection in a mirror, don't you appear to be in the mirror? Yeah, but we're not, are we?
No, but we know that.
Yeah, so we can also know that things that appear to have inherent existence don't have inherent existence. And that's what we're trying to get into our heads, right? Every object that we look at that has appears to have inherent existence doesn't. Just like every time we look in the mirror, we look in the mirror and we know we're not in the mirror. We're trying to do the same idea, same thing. Just the objects of knowledge are different. One's a reflection, one's a person in the mirror, one is inherent existence, and it's opposite, dependent arising. Dependent arising is the opposite of independent existence.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah, so,
Yes.
yeah.
I
So
get
this
it.
idea, look, this, if you get your head around this, this is really simple when it comes to actually working against illusions. Quarter of an hour. One slide. Okay, let's go. 6 root delusions. This is simple. We've got desirous attachment, sometimes called lust. Maybe other names too. Then we have hatred or anger, afflictive pride, ignorance, deluded doubt, and deluded views. These are the 6 root delusions. Now, each of these delusions has an opponent. It's got two opponents, each of these delusions. One opponent comes from the side of method, and one opponent comes from the side of wisdom. So if we look at the opponents from desirous attachment, what might be a single opponent to desirous attachment? Any ideas?
Generosity.
Look. Yes, Amy?
Anthea answered contentment.
Yes, it is, but it's not the major opponent to it. But contentment is an answer. Yep,
Set realizing the object you're interested in.
so that's the wisdom side. So there's the answer from wisdom. From the method side, in the Pali tradition, and included in the Bodhisattva tradition too, is if you have a desirous attachment to a person, what would be the opponent?
And
Maybe.
here asks, is it
Or anchor.
patience?
Oh, so again, okay, when we have desirous attachment to a person, what are we doing? What's the mind doing in relation to that
Emphasizing
person?
goodness of it.
So we are
Overemphasizing the goodness of it.
overemphasizing, overestimating the good qualities of
Yes.
this object, right?
Yes.
So how do we oppose that?
Look at the bad
Look at
qualities.
the
Better
bad
qualities.
qualities.
Or the bad
Yeah, it's
things.
really simple. So if you have a beautiful man, what we want to look at is I need to find all the ugly aspects of this man so I don't have desirous attachment to them. Because we don't desire the ugliness. This is, like I said, so the method thing is all, it's really simple. You just have to find the opposite of whatever the thing is. So if you have, suppose it was love, right? What was the opposite of love, you might think? Hatred, anger. Yeah, so what's the opposite of anger, hatred? No, that's right. They're two opposing forces, aren't they? And that's what you've got to do. You've just got to find the opposite. And the mind can't hold those two phenomena at the very same time. You can't hold something, you can't look at an object and see its ugly aspects and its beautiful aspects at the very same time. You have to do them one at a time. You might see, notice there's something that's ugly about them, but then you might go, oh, but there's also this good quality. You go, yep, but that's one thought, two thoughts. They're not at the same time. That's why you can oppose them. Yeah? When you're thinking, if a person were to have lust towards a person, they're looking at what they perceive to be all their good qualities and they want to possess them and have fun. Yeah? But if you wanted to stop yourself, what would you do? Yeah, so you start looking for all their ugly qualities, all the things that make them look yucky, and that will stop you desiring them. Like I said, on the method side, it's really easy, at least to discuss it, it's very easy. Just find the opposite. On the wisdom side, it's always wisdom arising selflessness or interest of inherent existence. The wisdom always stays the same, but the methods will change.
You had two answers from online. Esther said, is it changing your expectations so you see objects and people as they are?
Esther, the idea here is we have to first see what desirous attachment is and how it harms us. So desirous attachment is a wrong consciousness. So why is it a wrong consciousness? Because whatever that object is, we are enlarging its good qualities. In fact, that when we look at the object, only the good qualities appear. And where did the good qualities seem to be coming from? The object. And so now we're going to go, okay, when that appears to me, I want the object. I find that they're very pleasing to me, this object. I like to possess it. Okay, so how are you going to stop that? Now look at that object, and I've got to find the really unpleasant characteristics of this object. Well, what might they be? If they're a person, you just start stripping away the skin. Look beneath the skin. Is there anything that's really pleasing that you so nice now? And you're going to go like, no. So that stops the desirous attachment towards the object, if it's a person. But we'll go into this. I've got more to say about this later. Each of these, like I said, they've got six here. Sometimes when they're broken up into three, which, what do you think are the three major ones here? The mouth and you see three.
Ignorance,
desirous attachment, and hatred. They're the three, what they call the three root ones, and they're at the center of the 12 links. And when they're called six, then they're like this. And the first five are desirous attachment, hatred, afflictive pride, ignorance, and deluded doubt. And then this deluded views is made up of five wrong ways of looking at things. So you have the 10 root delusions. So you have 3, 6, some of the 5, other times it's 10. Okay, so let's look at attachment now, which I've just been talking about. So it's a deluded mental factor that observes its contaminated object, regards it as a cause of happiness, and wishes to possess it. Attachment means noticing a pleasant or attractive external or internal object and desiring. Now, attachment may have different meanings in different contexts. So that in the Western context, when you first hear the word attachment, it seems like a good thing. But the Buddhists thought, no, it's a bad thing. However, even in Buddhism, they use the word attachment and on the good side too. So I just want to mention that because you will come across it and might throw you when you read it. Yeah. So the Tibetan term translated as attachment is sometimes used to indicate strong affection and care. In this sense, Buddhas are attached to sentient beings, indicating that because of their strong compassion, they will never abandon sentient beings and will continuously work for them so that they can experience temporal and ultimate happiness. This feeling of closeness and care that Buddhas have for sentient beings is very different from attachment in the minds of sentient beings. This term attachment also comes up, it's also sometimes called craving, and sometimes it's also called grasping. They just depend upon the context, but they're all sort of aspects of this word called attachment. So the objects we can be attached to could be material objects, people, places, praise, even ideas. The attachment functions to produce discontent and to perpetuate the cycle of existence. Looking at our own experiences, we can see how true this is. And of course, you know, even with attachment itself, you know, there's a story of a person who, you can have it, so a person gets a Buddha statue. And they look at that statue and they think, wow, that statue is gorgeous, beautiful. So when you say things like that, where does the gorgeous and beauty of the statue seem to be? Yeah, well, it actually seems to be in the object, but you're right, it's more back here in the eye of the beholder, not what you're beholding. And this is what Shakespeare said, this is also what the Buddha says. And the objects themselves don't have these qualities, they're coming back from over here, the beholder who sees them and then imputes them to it. Anger, a deluded mental factor that observes its contaminated object, exaggerates its negative characteristics, considers it to be undesirable, and then wishes to harm it. You can see this is the opposite of the other one, isn't it? So anger or hatred is an internal state. It's not an external force. It arises when the mind cannot bear a person, an object, or a painful situation. Because of a deep-seated confusion about reality, the mind projects negative traits onto the object, blowing the traits of the object itself out of proportion. This exaggeration destroys mental peace, causes suffering, and motivates destructive actions. The mind then wrongly uses intellectual reasoning to justify hostility. But anger may also be a reaction to fear. Although anger may sometimes seem to make us courageous, our behavior when anger arises seldom remedies the problem, usually makes it worse. Again, this idea, we've got to get used to, like I said, inappropriate attention, what the mind is actually doing with the objects it engages in. And I found it really useful when I was walking my dog, just, you know, pause occasionally, just look at objects. And ask myself, does a tree seem to be like over there? Do all these objects appear to be like over there? You have to say, yes, of course they appear over there. And everybody else thinks they are over there. It all looks like that tree, right? So you can say, and you ask, and that's a conventionality. There's nobody's going to say, no, they're not over there. But again, this is without analysis, without examination. That's how it normally appears. So this normal appearance is called the appearance of conventional truth. It's a conventional truth. Again, if you look at the definition of conventional truth, you'll see the conventional truth is actually very much like a lie. It's not true at all. It's only true conventional or true as it appears to our conventional cognizers, our senses. But remember, our senses, the way our senses engage with that object is as if the object is over there already in place. In other words, the object does not depend upon us, it's there.
Just on that train of thought, Esther said that there's a quote at the beginning of one of the books she studied at uni where everything I like is either illegal, immoral, fascinating, or carcinogenic. It really defined her thinking for a long time, and it still takes a lot of mental exercise to understand that cognition doesn't just depend on things from the outside, but also positive sensation like peace, being calm, and just being present, which she has to cultivate with mental effort. So what do you, she asked if you had any thoughts on that.
That's true that we often have to apply effort in these understandings. I think one of the things to take away from this, Esther, is what I've suggested, right? Look around your house, your kitchen, or anything like that. Just ask yourself, do the things that you know I'm engaging with, what I'm looking at, thinking about, do they appear to be dependent on me or independent of me, or not dependent on me? If you come with the not dependent, that would be correct. Yeah. But in fact, they are dependent. Yeah. But the thing is, they appear. We've got to get the appearance first. Because we're questioning the appearances. And why is the appearances seem to have an intrinsic nature about them. If you want to understand anything, this is the first thing we've got to do. We've got to find the intrinsic nature that the object appears to have, because that's what you're knocking out. You're not knocking out the objects. The objects exist. We're not taking away things that exist. We want to take away non-existent things, which don't exist at all, but appear to us as if they exist, and we think they do. So like I said, so this clock, right, it exists. Right? Does this clock inherently exist? If so, no. Does it appear to inherently exist? Let's go, yes. How do I get rid of that false appearance? That's what we're sort of asking. It's not so much you're trying to get rid of the false appearance. What you're trying to get rid of is the belief in the false appearance. Well, I'll give you an example again, and I think it's in the text again, I've said it. You know, when I was a kid, I'd wake up screaming every night. Why? Because there's a man in my room. Mum and Dad would run down and they'd never find the man. So as I put all the lights off, I'd look back up and there he was again. This man always appeared to me. One day I took to bed a big knife and a huge metal bar, waited for that fellow to come again. Sure enough, he did. I leapt out of bed, ran him through the thing at him, and rushed with the knife up. Made a huge noise. What happened? A chair fell over, and on it, what it was like a chair hanging up like that, and my coat hanging over me. Looked like a man. So I saw a man. I believed there's a man. That's the problem, the belief in it. A man appeared, but there was no man there. Independence upon that man appearing, anger, fear, all these things arose, and I attacked it. But there's no man there. Right? So, they use the example of the rope later on the text again and again. In the dark, in the evening, a person walks by, they see what's actually there is a curled rope. They don't see a curled rope, they see a snake. They believe there's a snake, then they get scared. And so, what's actually there? There's a rope there. So, with us, we go, here's a person. A person exists, yes, they do. Well, they appear to exist without any dependence upon me whatsoever, without any dependence upon awareness at all. Could that be possible? That's when we do all this analysis. But the first part is identify the object and negate it. Inherent existence is the object. But again, you've got to go, what the heck is that? It's a non-existent, right? So in the book, if it did exist, this is how it would appear to you. Then you check and go, that's exactly how things appear to me. So I know then phenomena appear as if they have inherent existence, and I'm believing it. There's nothing wrong with it, is there? That's fine. You don't need to see the person. If I hear Geraldine's voice or your voice, I'll go, oh, Geraldine, or yourself. So I impute your name to the voice, and then, or the sound, but everyone does that.
Coming back to this, speech is contaminated.
Why is the speech not contaminated?
Because you can hear it is.
Really? Contaminant means it's arising from karma and delusion. That's what contaminates things. Well, ask yourself, is your friend enlightened? Is your friend enlightened?
No.
So she must be a sentient being, right?
She's what?
A sentient being.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Of course.
right. So also a samsaric sentient being. Right? So samsara is driven by karma and delusion. It pollutes everything, it contaminates everything. A little while ago, I was saying to you a couple of weeks back, this idea to you can look at yourself to be like a walking wound. You just attract pain and hurt. But why? If you ask yourself, why, how come? Because the karma and the delusion are running things, not you.
I A quote that's always stuck in my head is, life is 10% is what happens to you, and the other 90% is what you do about it, or, you know, whether you react or respond. It's always guided me well.
Now, here we come to ignorance, is what we've been talking about, and it's opposite. And one way of defining it is this: the mental factor is the opposite of the wisdom apprehending selflessness. Why is it said like this, right? This is because, in general, there are two definitions for ignorance, but the opponent for both of them is the wisdom apprehending selflessness. I'll give you the two definitions for... So ignorance is understood in two different forms: as a mental factor consisting of a simple absence of knowing, and as a cognition that apprehends objects in a distorted manner. They're the two. So, ignorance as an absence of knowing is like walking through a dark room and not knowing what's in there. Is that okay for you? You can't see the objects. You don't know what the objects are in the dark room. So you walk very carefully, don't you? There's like bump into something. You don't know. No? That's the first definition. And how that applies to things like the person is ignorant when they don't know karma, cause and effect, four noble truths, how to allow the three objects of refuge. They don't know. Just like when we're in that dark room, we don't know what's in the dark room. Now, the second form of ignorance is like I said, the example is you're walking in the late afternoon in India and you see a snake under a bush, except it's not, it's a coiled rope. So here you actually see something, but you misapprehend it. The other one, we didn't see anything, right? The darkness obscured us. We don't know what's up. This one, we do know something. That thing in the corner, but we wrongly know it. So see, if the coil of rope has been a snake. This one can relate back to us, whereby we have a sense of I or self, but we misapprehend it. So it appears to exist to us as being independent of the body and mind, not dependent. That the same misapprehension. So here we see, we have a self, a sense of self, and then we wrongly know it. We think it's inherent, but it's dependent. It's like seeing, you know, the rope. We see the rope, we acknowledge there's a rope, here we acknowledge we have a self. We think the rope is a snake. We think this dependent self is an inherent self. The self that's merely labeled is more than that. So if it's merely labeled as the body or the mind or both of them, or something separate from them. So that's how we misknow ourselves. That's a form of ignorance. We all know we have a sense of self, don't we? We should all think, yeah, I have a self. Okay. How does it actually exist? It's a mere imputation, a name given to the whole body and mind. Is that how we relate to ourselves? No. That's right. So that's ignorance. Yes, David?
Anthea asked me, but I don't think I've got the correct answer. She said, what was the first form of ignorance again? And I said, I thought it was a misapprehension.
Oh, the first one is just the one when you don't know something, Anthea. It's like, you know, walking in a dark room, you don't know where the furniture is. You can't see it. Everything was just like not knowing. So you cannot know the four noble truths. You cannot know the three jewels. You cannot know that whole kind of cause and effect. That's all called ignorance. Excuse me.
So, Eddie, is that kind of like when you first explain inherent existence, and we're very all new to the Dharma, we're like, what is it? What is that?
We don't even know
what the heck that is.
That's the first one.
Second one is like we kind of get an idea what it is, but we still go around, like not realize, like we kind of, every time we encounter an object, we still kind of instinctively go back to thinking it's really there out there.
Well, we have, we know of the conventional existence of the object, but like self. But so we know we have, well, self is common to all of us, right? But then the question is, how do we know it? And so in this, we know it in a mistaken way, in a wrong way. And so many of you know that, you know, the Buddhists first started refusing others from other intellectual systems. The first type of self they knocked out was a self that was permanent. And so everyone who believes the self is impermanent, they go, okay, if that were the case, how could you function? How could you feel anything? A lot of different questions you could ask. Until you come to the conclusion the self is not permanent. And it's okay, then maybe it's independent. This idea of something happening after death, self goes on, or the soul goes on somewhere else. So all these ways the Buddhists are saying, you guys are misapprehending how the self exists. You've got the object, but you're wrong about it. It's the same here. And they do that for the non-Buddhists. Then they go to the Buddhists and they go, okay, you Buddhists, you think this and that? Mistake, mistake, mistake. You've misapprehended the object. So here we've got, so I'm saying, the two types of ignorance. You know something, you've got the name of the object. You know the object exists, but you're wrong about how it exists. The other way is you don't even know the object at all. So not knowing and then misknowing. Both of these are wrong ways, both called ignorance, and they both are overthrown by the wisdom that's opposite both of those. Yeah, so the wisdom of the ultimate truth clears up both sides. Knowledge of the ultimate truth clears up both sides, you know, so your ignorance is completely removed. Right? We've already done about that. That's the first meditation. Oopsie. Okay, so find yourself comfortable in the seat, drop your shoulders, elongate your spine, and just let your body breathe itself normally and naturally. Then set an altruistic motivation for this meditation. So have you ever noticed how a bad mood can change how you relate to a sunny day? So our emotions are like our colored filters. They alter what we see and feel. Now, these distortions that take place through the colored filters, they don't actually show you who you are. And if you can understand this through experience and study, you can stop fighting your emotions and instead just watch them with a gentle interest. So you imagine that your mind is like a vast and clear blue sky. And these ideas we have of I want, I don't want, I like and I dislike. Can you see these, or imagine them, just like clouds drifting through the sky? These clouds are shaped with appear, change and dissolve. They're like the steam that arises from a teapot, briefly visible before disappearing. So what would happen if you were to say, when experiencing anger, anger is present instead of I am angry? If you could say, anger is present, instead of I am angry, you create a safe space between yourself and the emotion. It's like watching a wave from the shore and not being in the wave, being swept away. The mind is very much like the clear space behind the clouds. The mind is like a light that lets the shadows be seen. It is not as untouched. It's like a mirror reflecting the fire, but never burned. So today, if a strong emotion arises, simply name it and let it be. Express in your own clear, star-like nature. Now breathing in through your nostrils and exhale. Okay. Excuse me. Okay, so here are these six delusions again, and here we've got the antidotes for them. So just briefly, so I've got attachment first of all, and as I was saying before, the major opponent to attachment, especially to people in the Pali tradition, is ugliness. And it's also used in the Mahayana tradition, but there's also other antidotes. You can look at this impermanence, karma, and then using this other meditation called father, mother, brother, sister, child meditation. I'll talk about these when we come up to the one on attachment. With anger and hatred, the major opponent is patience, followed by karma, loving kindness, compassion. So if you have a good understanding of karma, loving kindness and compassion, these really form the foundation for a patient mind. So you can see here, pride, the antidote is contemplation of the extensive categories of the elements and aggregates. So you might not know what this means, so that the five aggregates form, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness. So if you have a look at that, there's a lot of material there. And then if you go into the elements, so it's another way of describing how a person is made up. So we've got six elements. We've got earth element relates to your bones, anything hard that's in the body. The water element relates to anything that's liquid in the body. The fire element to heat. Space, the initial gap and hole that's in the body. And we've got consciousness, and there's one other as well. We've got these six. So if you go in the text and look at this, it's massive. And so what they're trying to get at here is that if you think you're really smart, you have pride in yourself, check this stuff out. You find you're not as well thought of as you think you are. Then we have ignorance itself. So this is the wisdom realizing emptiness of inherent existence. Then we have doubt. So when you're not sure of something, what takes away that unsureness, the doubt?
Knowledge.
Yeah, knowledge, or certainty, certain knowledge of something. Right? If you know something certainly, you don't have doubt about it. So that's its opponent. Now, the key thing to take away from this is that delusions and their antidotes are exact opposites. So whenever you go through some sort of distressing emotional state, try to find out what it is, name it if possible, and then go, okay, what's the opposite of it? Because if I don't want to experience this state, I should start thinking about the other stuff. And your mind can't hold these two states together at the same time. It's impossible. Yeah. Like I said, if you find it, if I hate your ex-husband, for instance, right? You know, go there, think about it, wow, one time I used to love him. Right? What was it about him that I liked? And you have to try to remind yourself that, think of all the good qualities that he had, so you stop being so angry towards him and hateful, because your anger and hatefulness does nothing to him, nothing at all. There's a lot to you, though.
And if you can't recall his good qualities because you're having a hard time, you go, well, his mum loves him.
That's it.
It must
yeah.
be something that loving, lovable about him.
Yes, well, I remember this thing about Adolf Hitler, you know, so, monster and horrible. He only loved his dog, even though he killed it. And you see him playing with the children, he's dancing with a little kid. So, this you can always have something going on. There's no human being, it's all bad, impossible. In fact, what I love with all the things of Buddhism is that I have never seen a bad sentient being ever. I've seen bad mental states, though. They exist, but no bad sentient beings. And that's a really good thing to remember. I was spending a bit of time on attachment. There's a great teacher called Asanga, and he has got five different ways of looking at attachment. So a meditation on the feeling of suffering, pain within your own and others' continuum. So remember, so we're doing attachment towards people here. So no matter how good looking the person is, or what their qualities are and so forth, if they're not enlightened, they're going to experience pain, aren't they? So they all have pain and suffering within them, just like us. We have talked to before that even when it's good, all it is a diminishment of present suffering. It'll change again. So no matter how good looking they look at present, how healthy they are under the control of karma and delusion. So they're going to, there's suffering there, there's pain there. You need to remember that. Same thing with ourselves, right? So you do it on yourself first, then you look at the other and go, oh, the other's just like me. Like, if that's really hard, then just look at the other first. You do it the other way. Unpleasantness in relation to something else. You know what I'm saying? If you find someone who's got a great body and you have attachment to them, find a better one. You just compare and go, yeah, not so good. Decreases your attachment. So you might have heard of that guy, the monk who had attachment to his tea. He used to love drinking tea. Right? And he's on his deathbed and all he's thinking about is this lovely tea. And he wants to keep his thermos with him in the tea. And the person next to him said, oh, there's so much better tea than this in Tushita heaven. And that way he could drop his attachment to the ordinary tea. And then have attachment to better tea. But that's sort of how it works. You just find a better object. Okay, so this is an easy, simple one, isn't it? Here's a person drinking grog or alcohol. It seems to be good. You know, many people think, we spend a lot of money on alcohol, don't we? And most people who drink it like it. But then if you look at what it does to you, and perhaps you're overestimating the good qualities of attachment, because look what else comes along with it. Like, for instance, when you like it and you keep drinking, you're going to become an alcoholic. And then you've got a lot of problems. This is how they try and get rid of the attachment. There's this one, unpleasantness of the unsteady or change. Again, we're talking about subtle and coarse impermanence. If you think the person looks fantastic now and you want to be with them forever, and I thought about that. Even 50 years ago, they look pretty terrible, aren't they? Most times, they look very much different than what they do when they're younger. And 80, 90. In fact, I remember going to an old age home, and there was a woman lying next door to the person I was visiting. Really old, hunched up, caught in the bed. Really old. And I looked up above her, and there was her wedding picture up on the wall, and she looked nothing like that woman down there. You couldn't even tell they were the same two people. This is another way you can combat your own attachment to people. Remember, if you're going to be with them, they're going to age, they're going to get sick, and then they're going to die. They don't overestimate these good qualities. And then, of course, there's contemplation of ugliness and unpleasant. So again, that's when you're sort of looking beneath the skin, look at bodies when they die and all that sort of stuff. Okay, and then we have, so you can use this here also, not to be just towards people, but towards objects. So one of the students, what was her name? Jeanette McCready. So she has this lovely vase. You know? So she was saying, well, Eddie, I've got this lovely vase up on my wardrobe. It's just beautiful. And I'm lying on my bed looking at it, and I know I've got, even if I was dying, I'd be wondering, what's going to happen to my poor vase? Right? You go, yeah, I get it. You could do that with it. So how might you use it? Use any of these antidotes to work against having attachment to the vase. What do you think? Which ones could you use here? So you wouldn't use the first one, isn't it? Because the vase doesn't have a feeling of suffering. Right? You put that one aside. Second one you could also put aside, but it has to do with the body. Third one, you could put it aside. But the last two, you could use. The vase is undergoing subtle and coarse impermanence. It is not going to be there forever. Contemplation of the ugliness. What's the vase made out of? Yeah, clay, mud, paint. There's nothing inherently beautiful about that vase at all. So this is the idea, this is how you use your understandings to go up against an object of attachment. In this case, not a person. But if you were to do it to a person, we've got two, and I'll just call them familial and structural. So if we look at the familial, it's a family thing, right? So this is how the Mahayana student could oppose attachment to another person. And so I'm in my second picture, right? So if I were just to assume that anyone in here that I was attracted to was also in their 70s, what would I think? You think, well, this person is my sister. If they're older than you, so I'm talking from a perspective of me being a man, I look at the same age as a woman, and this is my sister. She's older, this is my mother. If she's younger, this is my daughter. If it was a woman, you'd look at the man, same age, this is my brother. If he's older, this is my father. If he's younger, this is my son. All these ways will stop you having a lust towards the person of the opposite age. Remember that this type of thinking is based on the idea that we've been born again and again and again and again. Right? So we can look at it like that, and that stops that way. So that's from, like I said, the familial side. If you look at structure, it means impermanence and the ugliness. Whatever you want to take up with, they're impermanent by nature, they're changing like right now, and the process is not under their control. If you look beneath the skin that's changing, that what you see, you're going to find blood, lymph, bones, nothing that's particularly attractive to you. So this way you can use these two. In fact, this is when you feel strong desire, stop. Mentally name five body parts, like the lungs or the skull or blood, bones, these sort of things. Then say sister, mother, daughter. Use them both like that. It's a real great way to put up a barrier against desirous attachment. Okay, last meditation. Let us settle in a comfortable upright posture. Let your breath flow naturally. And send an altruistic intention to abandon desirous attachment to people. So have you ever felt either engrossed or trapped by a single image of beauty? This meditation is about breaking the spell of attraction through two clear lenses, structure and family. When we see others fully, we are no longer prisoners to our impulses. If you can imagine a deep, still lake, well, the surface of that lake reflects the sky, but the truth about the lake lives in the depths below. So what do you discover when you look beyond the skin? You'll find the delicate organs and the bones that sustain every human life. It's like seeing the intricate movement inside a beautiful and golden watch. But how does the heart respond when you call a stranger a mother or father, brother or sister, son or daughter? Does the mind shift from wanting to possess to wanting to protect? The familial meditation is like finding a long lost relative in a crowd of unfamiliar faces. It can both be with exist together. And the answer is yes. The structural view grounds it in the reality of impermanence and ugliness. As the familial view opens your heart with warmth, and together they can create a state of mind that's both clear and deep and human. But today, if you like, just choose one person you find attractive, and then use this meditation, the familial and the structural. Recognize them as a family member and see what's beneath the skin. And carry the sense of kinship and clear seeing into every moment of the day. Okay, let's come to the end of our class. Is there anything you'd like to ask, any questions you'd like to say? So there might be a question, they say, one of the questions, why is ugliness used as a term for the internal organs? Because they're not by nature either. Now again, ugliness is just a term imputed to another phenomenon. So we give them the name. Yeah, or impure objects. So the idea of using these terms is to counter the hallucination of skin-deep perfection. So on one side, we're exaggerating the good qualities with attachment. So we've got to really come at it, you know. So I think it's turned ugly. Does the meditation mean you have to hate the human body? So when I first started doing this, that was one of the things that came up for me. I was like, oh, I'm actually beginning to dislike people. They're all like appearing ugly to me. That was a wrong idea, wrong way I went. Again, so how do, again, like I said, these antidotes work within the law of what's called contradiction. So the mind cannot view one object as pure and impure at the same time. It can't see it as ugly and beautiful at the same time, in other words. And just like light and darkness can't occupy the same corner of a room. Now, that's why you just put one there and you're going to get just the one. But again, so I say, if you find yourself distraught over anything, try and work out what's that called. This is the most, if you can't identify what it is that's afflicting you, how are you going to know how to oppose it? That's what's so important to work out. This is called this. Oh, I know what the opposite of that is. It's this. And I'll need to do this now. Okay, so we know there are six root delusions. You'd like to tell me three of them. Ignorance, hatred, desirous attachment. Yeah.
Wrong views.
Deluded views, or wrong views, deluded doubts. And one more thing, pride, was it? Yeah, afflicted pride. Okay, and of these antidotes, we sort of focused on attachment today. Next week, we'll focus on anger, hatred, and again, show different ways of opposing it. So you do know of two ways to oppose this desirous attachment. So next, find out whatever you can on these root delusions. There are two antidotes to attachment. Try to remember what these are. You've got to stop ugliness and then family. Colour that with the generation of anger and how these delusions create colour. So, thank you. I'm glad you're here. We can talk about this. Let's dedicate the rounds and then we'll break. So join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of the living Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme dual, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. As a prayer for His Holiness's long life, the wish granting, wish fulfilling dual, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind teens and guts, so I beseech. May all your humble wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And the last prayer for Rinpoche's fifth return. In holding and spreading the moon's precious and complete teachings for explanation and practice, you reward the honor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this request.